Now, we've a lot to be proud of in our great nation, from language and history to science and education. But what puts great in Britain for me is folk what live here, like me and thee. A tiny island nation stuck in North Atlantic. We punch above us weight as though we're gigantic. And reason we've been at top for some time is them that serve country and made sacrifice. Your soldiers, your sailors, your airmen and all, millions of it years have answered the call to say goodbye to fathers and mothers and serve alongside new sisters and brothers. They shave your head and send thee to sea, or give thee a rifle and dress you up like a tree. That's been way for many generation. I'd love to say why is all imagination, but for many it's not. It's as real as can be for them that's fought for us to be free. I'm lucky to have known many a great man that served in Falklands, Iraq and Afghan. I've always been proud to have them as mates, knowing what they've did that can't be replaced. It's true, some have suffered since taking that oath. I'm proud to see the resilience and post-traumatic growth.
My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. In this episode, we speak about the personal stories of remembrance from previous guests. We talk about friends, the history of armistice, tradition, and the future. We also speak about what service means to us and how community comes together at this time. A remembrance special from the battlefields of the First World War to living life now. This is Declassified. Emily, can you tell us the origin story of remembrance?
Thanks, Michael. I think there are a number of components that we've come to expect of as being a part of Remembrance Day. And a couple of them existed even before the end of the First World War in 1918. So the Last Post, the mournful song that we know as played over the graves of soldiers, had been a tune that would have been recognised from 1900. It had been played in 19th century wars, and it had become a standard whenever memorials to those wars were unveiled all over Great Britain. The War Graves Commission, who undertook what is probably the most extraordinary work in the aftermath of the Great War, have been at work since 1917. They'd been formalising the cemeteries of those that didn't come back from France, who died there, because there were simply too many to be brought back, to be found space in graveyards. And there was a real concern that if people were able to pay for that, those that were able to pay for that would be far fewer than those that couldn't, and that this would be really an unacceptable divide and judgment on the service of those who'd served. So a decision had been taken to create the war grave cemeteries and that they would be run by the War Graves Commission. And they're still doing that extraordinary work today. But then there are the components that I think we know best, and it's the Remembrance Day service itself, which in Great Britain focuses on the cenotaph in Whitehall in London. And that the very first ceremony wouldn't happen for a year. And in the meantime, the war came to an end. And I think it's worth noting that although the war had come to an end everywhere but the Western Front, on the 11th of November 1918, the war was still very much ongoing. There were the people that fought it there, back in Whitehall, certainly the munitions industry, everybody thought that that section of the war we know best, the Great War we know best, was going to go on and be fought into 1919, possibly even into 1920. And then the German state effectively collapses. The chiefs of staff are replaced by much more sensible people who realise that the war simply cannot go on from the German point of view, and they seek an armistice from the Allies. It is effectively a surrender, but it's called an armistice, and an armistice means the formal ending to fighting. It doesn't mean a peace treaty. It signals the beginning of a peace process, but it doesn't mean a peace treaty. It simply means that fighting will stop. And it's when those negotiations, those initial negotiations for an armistice are concluded, that the date of the 11th of November 1918 at 11 o'clock in the morning, so the 11th hour of the 11th month and the 11th day, that's agreed as the moment that the armistice will come into effect. And it's often spoken of by historians when the guns stop pounding out as the stillness that could be heard around the world. That's probably a little artistic license, but more or less there's some truth to it. And then the peace process begins almost immediately. There's 6 months in Paris where the peace treaty is put together, and it's signed right at the end of June into the beginning of July. In Britain, it's an important moment for remembrance because it's decided to have a peace day and a victory parade in London. And a wooden cenotaph is designed and built and put up in Whitehall. It looks exactly the same as the one that we have now. And a parade goes past it, and it's a victory parade. But that sentiment doesn't last very long. What people realise is that the cenotaph design, which simply has the words "the glorious dead" on it, with no names, so that everyone who's lost someone in France, who can't bring them back and put them in their local churchyard, can go and look at that cenotaph and see it as the gravestone for their loved one. So by November 1919, something very like our Remembrance Day has begun to come together. The cenotaph, the wooden cenotaph, has been replaced with a Portland stone cenotaph. It still carries the dates and the term, "Our Glorious Dead." The king has had a dinner at Buckingham Palace for the French president. And the next day, there is a reception in Buckingham Palace Garden, and the very first 2 minutes silence is held to commemorate the dead. The next year, in 1920, the unknown soldier is chosen from the ranks of graves that are marked where we don't know the name of the soldier, and he's brought back and buried in Westminster Abbey. And there's a parade that goes past the cenotaph and ends up at the Abbey. And that year, the next year, 1921, is when the very first artificial poppies are sold. So they're poppies that are mostly textiles, or either textiles or knitting. 9 million of them are sold, and the money goes to support the soldiers who have returned, who are struggling, and also the families of the dead. By 1922, we have the very first poppy factory. So all the components that we now recognise as making up Remembrance Day are in place. And also what is in place is a real sense in the country that there was no victory. There's a much heavier reckoning being made around Remembrance Day. It's taken on a much more sombre tone. The country is in great economic difficulty. There is revolution around the world. The war to end all wars has not, in fact, done that. By 1920, there are 30 wars around the world, and there will be war every single day of the 20th century. Winston Churchill, who was in charge of much of the demobilisation effort at this point, writes in his history of the aftermath of the First World War, probably the best words I've ever read on it: "I awoke from my armistice dream, and we all found ourselves in the rough, dark, sour and chilly waters in which we are swimming still."
David, is remembrance a simple concept for yourself?
No, it's not simple at all for me. I see it through both a historical and a personal perspective. From the historical side, you know, I recognise the real importance to collectively remember, you know, that wound that was inflicted on this nation by war in the first half of the 20th century. You know, we've got a small memorial. I live in a very small village, and it's got half a dozen names on it from guys lost in World War One. And I just think about what a huge impact that would have been to a small farming village in sort of 1914 or to 1918. And that, you know, it saddens me. I feel that importance and the weight of that remembrance and the significance of it, and that's from the sort of historical perspective. From a personal perspective, you know, I think about it in different layers. You know, I think about people I've known who've served and who've fallen, either those that I met through training, or soldiers that I've trained as an instructor, or obviously those I've served alongside in battalion. But then, you know, I also think of the violence and the death that I've experienced and I've witnessed firsthand. And unfortunately, you know, that those are all too easy to remember, the men who've passed. And you know, I've been there and I remember them. I remember them in death. And I also think of people who've become my very, very close friends who've been severely wounded in war. Those who have sacrificed their health, they've sacrificed their youth, they've sacrificed things that most people take for granted, maybe their mobility or even their chance to have a family. So I remember those all those things in those different sort of layers, and that's very important to me. So no, it's not simple. And when I compare those layers and I think about my own education and experience of remembrance, and I think back to being a kid, and when I was a kid, the old guys that used to sell the poppies in the street, I've got a vivid memory of buying one in York train station with my mum and my brothers, and those guys, they were still Tommies. You know, they were in their 80s. You know, they were old guys, but they were still the Tommies. Or there were guys that had served in World War II, because back in the day when we were kids, you know, mate, it was our granddads, it was our grandfathers who had served that generation. So what I'm saying is, we people our age still have that tangible link with World War I and with World War II within our living memory, in the of our grandfathers or people who used to buy poppies from in the street. But what I'm concerned with is that kids being born today won't have that tangible link to that past. So that I spoke initially about that historical layer of remembrance and almost feeling that still that wound of those wars and having that tangible link with the past. But for some kids being born today, you know, the distance in time between them and World War One is as far away as maybe us and when we were born and the Crimea. And very soon, generations, that distance will be as far away as Waterloo or Trafalgar. And I'm just worried that their link with those really important conflicts will be the way that we, you and I, think about maybe, you know, Waterloo or Trafalgar, that it's, you know, it's something that happened in history books or exists in museums or costume dramas, and it's almost fantastical instead of being very real. And I just think that we have got a duty to not let that happen. I just think remembrance is so important. And therefore I ask, you know, parents, teachers, or people with influence, to ensure that remembrance is contemporized, not to replace the memory of the Great War and World War II, but to ensure that the act of remembrance is preserved and its gravitas is felt by generations to come.
Nick, can you tell me about your granddad?
Yeah, of course. I mean, his name was Dr. Ian English. He was an incredibly cerebral guy, but also amazingly brave. He came from a sort of military family. You know, his father, fought at the Battle of the Somme, got bayoneted there. So he had all these tales from his father. But quite remarkably, he was a surgeon during the Second World War, fought a number of battles, but I suppose the key one was being on the hospital ships during D-Day, attending to the wounded. So seeing a lot of pretty horrific things, but keeping very stoic during the whole period. And then quite remarkably after that, he was sent off to help repatriate a lot of the POWs in Japan, the Allied POWs there, and went off and got to this camp obviously didn't know what to expect at all, turned up and saw some horrific things you can only imagine. Nobody would have expected or could have seen what they saw. And he wandered around the camp, horrifically, you know, shocked by the whole thing. And then what was really sad, he came across his cousin. His cousin he hadn't seen for 4 years, didn't know he was in this POW camp at all, and was, you know, in tears seeing the state of his friend, his cousin, who he managed to get back to the UK. But it affected him for the rest of his life. But what was also quite special about him, he came back, you know, I think he buried a lot of these memories, which so many, I guess, do. But he became a pioneering heart surgeon and anaesthetist at the started his career and did a lot of work at the Royal Brompton, where he invented the Brompton Manly ventilator, a portable ventilator which is used to this day still, and obviously has saved a lot of lives. And that for me was very, very special, that someone can go through so much, bury quite a lot of it, but carry on and achieve so much in later stages of their lives. So he was a very, very special man.
Sean, who do you remember?
So I remember a friend called Chris Harkett. I knew Chris when I was young. So we grew up together as kids. Our parents were in the forces together. We both left school. He was in a year above me. He went off to college and then on to join the army. And he joined the Royal Welsh. And I went off and I joined the army then not too long after. Chris was, everyone liked Chris. Like, his personality was infectious. He was this lad from South Wales. He just had this typical valley boy sort of banter about him, really cheeky chappy, would burst into song about, in, you know, 90s boy band songs and all that sort of stuff, you know, and would have no problems in doing that in any forum he was in, whether it was lads, girls, both, parents, whatever it was. He was just a really funny lad, and no one, like nobody, disliked Chris. Like, no one ever had a bad word to say about him. And he wasn't a fighter or anything like that. He was just a nice person. So me and him both joined the forces, different units, for different reasons. And we saw each other periodically, as you know, as you do when you're in the military, not in the same unit. You pass cross each other every now and again. And I remember before I'd deployed away to Afghanistan at one stage, I got in a bit of bother, and he came to pick me up in his mini, and it was must have been about midnight. And on that journey to take me home, he got a flat tire and in his brand new mini, of which I think that journey to pick me up to get me out of a bit of bother cost him a fair few hundred quid. But the next time we crossed paths after that was when he took over from me in Afghanistan. We sort of sat and had a cup of tea with each other in the Nafi in Camp Bastion and shared a few stories and reminisced about the past, about when we were kids. High-fived. I left to go home, and he, I think it must have been about 2 months later, was killed in action, in the same area that I'd been operating in. So he, for me, is the one person that I directly go to on Remembrance Day and always remember.
Lev, thanks for coming on. Have you seen Remembrance in other countries?
Have. I've been very lucky, you know, in my travels to have witnessed Remembrance services or personal acts of Remembrance all around the world, really. Some of the more notable places that I've come across, either war cemeteries or memorials. The Kanchanaburi Cemetery in Thailand is a big one, and I happened to be there for a remembrance service on some of my very first travels back in 2001, and I remember that being a real reminder that, you know, the not just the British Army, but the Commonwealth and you know, soldiers of all nations have paid that ultimate sacrifice. And when you go somewhere on the far side of the world and see very familiar names on these war graves, it really does bring it home. And that's something I've seen all around the world. Back in 2004, once when I was on one of my big travels, I was hitchhiking all the way from England to India, and I happened to be passing through Afghanistan. And I was just, this wasn't with the army, I was just a student backpacker. I got to Kabul, and I remember I'd read somewhere about a British war cemetery to soldiers that had fought in the previous conflicts in Afghanistan in the 1840s and the 1880s. And I wanted to go and find it. So I set off and I was asking some of the local people. And it wasn't really, you know, this was before the days of sort of Google Maps and things. So it wasn't as simple as just sticking it in your phone and off you go. So I was sort of having to ask around the local bazaars, and some people had heard about it. And I got pointed in the right direction. And eventually, after a good couple of hours going through the alleyways and the mountains, I found this cemetery. And it was a beautiful old sort of walled garden, basically, filled with the old sort of mulberry trees. And it was amazing to find all of these old graves in there from soldiers that had fought in the First and Second and Third Afghan Wars. And there were a couple of more modern ones that had been installed by British regiments that had sort of passed through in just after 2001. But it was tended to by this old Afghan guy. And it was really heartwarming to see that, you know, this place, despite the fact that we, you know, we'd fought there and we'd been booted out many times over the sort of 19th century, that the Afghans had actually looked after it. And that was very sort of heartwarming and reassuring, really. And in my travels, I've always sort of tried to pay my respects and see, you know, go and visit the graves of the war dead, because I think it's important to remember that, you know, that people have paid that sacrifice all around the world for our freedom, and that, you know, it's important that we remember those that didn't make it home.
Helen, can you tell me a significant remembrance memory?
Yes. So I think the one for me, and I remember it every year, and especially at remembrance time, was a visit to the cemetery in Kabul. Really poignant for me. It was November 2005. I'd recently started in the permanent joint headquarters, PDHQ, as a desk officer working on operational policy around Afghanistan. And one of my roles was reporting into ministers any incidents where our people had been significantly injured or killed. And in that role, when you're writing those incident reports up, you're including, you know, obviously the name of people, their age, whether they were married or with a partner, where they had children. So it made it really personal. And so remembrance, I think, took on a different significance for me after that. And I just remember that visit, passing through the wooden gates in Kabul. It's the cemetery, such a peaceful place. It's surrounded by, obviously this was a little time ago now, a wall, which kind of shut out the sound and noise of the Kabul city. It was peppered with trees across the graveyard. And there was a plaque on the far end of the wall with all the names of all of the people, British forces included, who had lost their lives over many years in Afghanistan. And, you know, when the bugler plays the last post, it's just spine tingling. And so I think remembrance for me is not just about World War One and World War Two, but it's the people that have given their lives in all of the operations since. And every remembrance, it takes me back to that place in Kabul. And I'll always remember those who lost their lives in the defense of our country and of our values. And it's so important that we never forget.
Andy, what was your most poignant remembrance memory?
My most poignant remembrance memory is actually back in 1984. So I was a rifleman serving with 3rd Battalion, the Royal Green Jackets, who were on a tour of West Belfast. So that's a 4.5-month tour over the winter period. And I remember on the 11th of November, standing on the roof of North Howard Street Mill, which is between the Falls Road and the Shankill Road. And I remember the bugler playing the last post. And it was a very cold, grey day. And I just remember the sound of the bugle was really powerful and piercing. You could almost, you know, feel it in your body. And I just remember a tremendous feeling of sadness. And that sadness was particularly strong and intense because we'd actually lost a member of our battalion on the 19th of October. He was killed by the IRA in an ambush on the Turf Lodge estate. So it was only a few weeks before that we'd had to come to terms with that incident and that loss. So it was a very, very powerful emotional moment. And that has stayed with me for my life.
So what does it mean to you now then? What does remembrance mean to you?
It brings back, and I suppose it means it's a pride in having served. It also is sadness. And that is because I think about Gunner Tim Utteridge, who was in Royal Horse Artillery attached to our battalion for the tour. And, you know, Tim was a lovely young guy who'd, yes, he'd chosen to serve, but, you know, to die in those circumstances at such a young age was incredibly, incredibly sad. And I suppose for me, I still feel very sad when I think about Tim in particular, because he didn't have the opportunity to live a life in the way that I have. So although I'm definitely very proud to have served, I still feel very sad just thinking about the loss, you know, of Tim, but also, you know, the loss of all of the young men and women who've given their lives in service of our country and haven't had the opportunity to, you know, to live a life. That sacrifice is incredible.
Louise, is remembrance an emotional time for you?
Remembrance is so emotional for me. I find myself really bubbling over when I go to any remembrance service or anything that, you know, where we are remembering. As a military spouse, my husband has deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, both in combat situations. And I'll never forget one time when I was on a train going to London. It must have been 2011. And it was Remembrance Day, and 11 o'clock, there was an announcement on that train, obviously for the 2 minute silence. And I was sat on a table with these three older ladies and I listened and I just broke down. My husband was deployed at that time and it was difficult. You know, you always think in that 2 minute silence how lucky you are and the guilt over how lucky you've been as a military spouse that my husband has come home every time he's deployed. So that particular 2 minute silence, 2011 on that train, will stay with me forever. Those ladies gave me a tissue. They gave me huge hugs from strangers. Those stranger hugs meant so much in that moment. And I felt very thankful that my husband came home from that tour as well. I think remembrance forever is changed once you've had a soldier deployed in a war situation. And I think it's a moment to reflect and be thankful. And I feel eternally lucky that my soldier always came home.
Jim, what's your relationship with remembrance?
I was in Afghanistan 10 years ago. And when I returned from Afghanistan, I really avoided remembrance because I think it brought some things to the surface, which I wanted to avoid. But I run a service charity called Mission Motorsport. And in 2014, we'd been given a weekend at Anglesey late in the year when normally motorsport has come to an end. And I was persuaded against what I thought was my better judgment at the time that we should run a motor race, an endurance motor race to mark remembrance across the remembrance weekend. And at the time, it felt like Guernsey launching a space program. But this has grown. And 7 years on, where we still run a 12-hour race that will stop and we bring the cars into the pit lane and the people come together, the racers, the mechanics, the support, the marshals come together with 600 or 700 people and stand in the silence of the falling notes of the last post and that 2-minute silence. And we think about things that happened a century ago, and we think about the end of the Second World War 75 years ago. But for our audience, for those wounded, injured, or sick who are taking part, they're thinking about something that's altogether more current, their friends, their colleagues, and their own loss. And they're thinking about their families. As I stood there for the first time in 2014 and the sun shone on our back in a rare break in the weather up in Anglesey on the cliffs overlooking the Irish Sea, you could hear a pin drop. And I realized at that time that I was going to have to spend race of remembrance, marking remembrance in that way every year since. And so now in 2020, I think this year, this mad year, it's more important than ever that we mark remembrance and we think of all of those who walk forward towards the danger, of those who risk their lives for others and those who have fallen by the wayside. And so we innovate. We, in 2020, take our racing online, but we will still hold a service of remembrance from a pit lane. We'll do it as a drive-through COVID-safe event, but we'll stream it in order that our beneficiaries and that motorsport community can come together to mark remembrance in the way that we love, because it's important.
Richard, who do you remember?
Lance Corporal Darren Hicks. He was a Coldstream guard, and you know, I was a Royal Marine, so we didn't know each other in service. We grew up together. You know, I knew him from back home in Penzance in Cornwall. You know, from about 12 years old, the local rugby club. And I think that's what shocked me more, is that we were kids together and I didn't meet him in the context of the military. You know, we had all these memories of playing rugby together and running around Penzance and going out when we were kids, and then seeing him as a family man. And he joined the army before I joined the Royal Marines. And when you meet people in the context of the military, there is always a chance that those people you're meeting may eventually pay the ultimate price. But when news got back that Hicksy had been killed in Babaji, I've never felt a shock like it. You know, we all experienced loss during those times. But because I knew him in a different context, and I'll just always think about him playing rugby back in Penzance and someone saying to him, "Hicksy, look, there's a dead bird." And he looked up instead of down. You know, and I had all of these different memories going through my head. And you know, he was a wonderful family man. And Cornwall, certainly down where I grew up at the bottom, that's a tight-knit, very tight-knit community. And he was from Mousel. And, you know, the fishing community there just poured out at his funeral. And again, I attended so many military funerals during those times, but never at home, you know, my home, in that context. And to see all the guards there, it was really tough to wear that one, much tougher than the others, because you know we were kids, you know, we were friends as kids before we joined the military. So every Remembrance Sunday, you know, my Facebook feed comes alive from people at home remembering Hicksy, and he's always the first person that I remember. What an absolutely wonderful bloke, taken far too soon. Fantastic soldier, fantastic family man, and a great Pirates rugby player.
JJ, as an unexpected survivor of the Afghan War, is it important for you to live a full life now when friends of yours didn't make it home?
Yeah, but that perspective and that sort of understanding is hard earned in your own head, because the first thing you need to get over essentially is the guilt. It is the beginning with the guilt of I've survived and they haven't. And actually, that's even worse when genuinely they were better blokes than I was, you know. And Sam, for example, had a son. So in my head, he's worth more than I was. So getting beyond that is one part. But even when you move beyond that, you begin to think of your accomplishments. How do their families reflect on them? What do they think when they see somebody having having something that that their son, their brother, that Sam and Ollie just couldn't have. But actually, that makes you realize that the biggest thing they were robbed of was choice. That their lives in the blast were taken in an instant, and they lost the choice. And we always have a choice in life. Even at our lowest ebb, your basic choice is to give up or to keep fighting. Now, they never got that, whereas I've been given that opportunity. And then you realize, well, if they didn't have a choice, why should I have a choice? I have to keep fighting. I have to keep moving forward. And so that's what motivates me. That's what pushes me. It pushed me through my recovery. It pushed me through the Invictus Games. It carries me through my career as a TV presenter. And on to Strictly. I mean, that's the thing. When I stand on the stage here, I can't think of a better platform to show to them that I didn't waste the opportunity that I was given and they weren't. And I know, first of all, that they would find it hilarious. You know, the lads would love the glitter and the sparkle, but also they would love that one of the guys that looked up to them once upon a time went on to achieve something with their life and take the opportunity that they didn't have. And then the really remarkable thing about this is that actually at this point on the platform that I'm on, I've begun to receive messages from war widows, bereaved mothers from warfare, that are saying that there is no, you know, there is nothing more of a comfort than to turn on the TV and see somebody taking an opportunity that my loved one just didn't get and doing it for them. And I've not said it publicly, but that's how they understand it. And therefore, you know, it fills me with, you know, an unbelievable honor to think like that. But that's the thing. You know, I still think remembrance is really important. I think it is important that we have a day where we have this moment of pause. But at the same time, you know, I get up every day and I remember and I ensure that I don't forget. But actually, it's not just about having a thought. It's about having a life. You know, we and yes, it's close to me because I lost somebody. You know, I lost guys that I truly cared about. But actually, we've lost people that we'll never meet, you know, that have sacrificed on our behalf. And so really, it's about ensuring that you get up every day and you live. You live for those that can't. And yeah, you live in honor of the dead.
We've had the privilege to bring together some amazing people in this podcast, sharing what remembrance means to them and how community brings us together. We posed the question of what remembrance means to our next guest, and this is what Prince Harry had to say.
Remembrance Day for me is a moment for respect and for hope. Respect for those who came before us and hope for a safer world. The act of remembering, of remembrance, is a profound act of honour. It's how we preserve the legacies of entire generations and show our gratitude for the sacrifices they made in order for us to be able to live the lives we live today. We wear the poppy to remember the two world wars, what our nations endured and the lives that were lost. We wear it for the British and Commonwealth soldiers who lost their lives in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Bosnia, the Falklands, and Northern Ireland. I wear the poppy to recognise all those who have served. The soldiers I knew, as well as those I didn't. The soldiers who were by my side in Afghanistan, those who had their lives changed forever, and those that didn't come home. I wear it to celebrate the bravery and determination of all our veterans and their loved ones, especially those in our Invictus family. These are the people and moments I remember when I salute, when I stand at attention, and when I lay a wreath at the cenotaph. Being able to wear my uniform, being able to stand up in service of one's country, these are amongst the greatest honours there are in life. To me, the uniform is a symbol of something much bigger. It's symbolic of our commitment to protecting our country as well as protecting our values. These values are put in action through service. Service is what happens in the quiet and in the chaos. It's what happens in the darkness. It's what happens when people aren't looking. It's what happens on and off the battlefield. It's about carrying out our duty as soldiers. And for me, as a father, a husband, and as a human being, it's how we uphold these values in every aspect of our lives. And I've been fortunate enough to meet the most incredible veterans over the years. The banter with Chelsea pensioners to the veterans at the Field of Remembrance, all the D-Day vets, they all hold a really special place in my heart. And with any of these guys, it's like meeting an old mate. We may not have served together, but we stand together with a shared understanding. Now, I spent 10 years in the military with two tours in Afghanistan. When I get asked about this period of my life, I draw from memories. I draw from what I remember and who I remember. Like the first time we were shot at and who I was with. The casualties we saw and those we saved. And the first medevac we escorted out of contact in a race against time. Once served, always serving, no matter what. Lest we forget our fallen comrades, our relatives, our friends. Lest we forget how different things must have been 100 years ago and how different they'll be 100 years from now. This is what Remembrance Day means to me. The solidarity of a shared value system, of our community that fights for what is right and honourable, no matter what. Even when we can't all be together, we always remember together.
Maria, who do you remember?
Well, primarily, I remember my son, Nathan, who was a WO2 in the REs. Nathan was born in Germany to a military family. My father was in the army, and Derek was obviously in the army for 22 years. He was born in Germany, and he was dragged from pillar to post, from Germany to Aldershot, and Aldershot back to Germany. We finally settled in Lincoln, and he went to school here in Lincoln, and he was a very clever lad, actually. He passed all his GCSEs with flying colours, with not even really trying. Anyway, he always wanted to join the army. That was his thing. He was in the cadets, and at 16, he joined the Royal Engineers, and he excelled. Whatever he did, he was a perfectionist. He, you know, whatever he did, he had to be the best. And he went through the ranks, and then he went to, he was posted to the Household Cavalry for 5 years, which he really loved. And he served in Afghanistan with, obviously, with Prince Harry. And he wasn't the same, really, when he came back. His wife said he came back emotionless. And, you know, he seemed fine, you know, on the face of it, but he always came here for Christmas. Not Christmas Day, but Boxing Day. And about 3 years before his death, he actually broke down and cried. We knew there was something wrong. And he just said, you know, he just felt so guilty that he had lived while a lot of his friends had died. So we knew something was wrong, you know, but he wouldn't open up. And I think he did go sick in the army with depression, but I don't think he told the full story. And also because it blocked his promotion, he didn't push it. So when they wanted to see him again, he just sort of said he's always all right now, and of course he wasn't. So 3 years ago, in New Year, he took his own life. He's not the only one. We have lost over 200 since Nathan. And it's tragic, really, because, you know, they weren't just killed in action. They're killed through what they've seen and done, and that's just dreadful.
Des, why is it important to remember those that are still here?
Well, I can take you back, pal, to about 3 years ago, and I was at the absolute lowest point I've ever been in life. I can remember being quite timid, where in the past when I'd felt down, I was quite aggressive. So people could trigger that and see it and say to me, how are you feeling? What's going on? Why are you feeling the way you are now with regards to being aggressive? And this time I just went, as a bit of an introvert, I just didn't speak to people. So even though I had a good close network around me, such as yourself and a good family partner, it just didn't, I just couldn't speak to anyone. From there, I tried to commit suicide, and it was literally a toss of a coin that I'm still here. So I've got that to be thankful of. But the next morning, I had to go and speak to my mum and tell her how I'd been feeling and what I'd tried to do. I remember the look on her face. It was pure devastation. Then it turned to anger. There was not just one emotion that I could tag to that, to the way she was feeling. But I know she could see in my mind that it wasn't controlled by me. It was something deeper. So having that strong support network that I just mentioned then helped me get to like some therapy, and was key to my development and recovery and certainly the growth thereafter. You and I then done the podcast, which was absolutely fantastic. It went out. I got loads of real good support and well wishes. But there was a small element of our community that reached out and was saying, I'm feeling the same as you. How have you got through it? Which was a real key moment for me to sort of zone in on focus on supporting that small elements, but then seeing how we could push it out to, you know, a much wider community. And what we were doing is talking about the way I got through therapy. I know I've been helped by other members of the military community, like David Wiseman, giving me some good tips on when I've gone through that, but then introducing real positive habits such as cold water therapy, good nutrition, 45 minutes of fitness each day, and obviously speaking to my good friends and networking within our community was key to that. And then obviously I could pass that skill set on. What I was noticing though was a real loss of identity from some people. So whether they've come back from the battlefield and they were then living on camp, they were lacking a little something, or they felt that way, or whether they'd left the military completely and then joined civilian life and cut their, you know, channels of communication, if you like, and really lost that spirit that they would get from the friends that have been in similar situations to them. And yeah, that seriously loss of identity was what I was noticing right the way throughout. So nowadays, I do remember how many people come there for me and how I can give back to our community. And I just want those people to know that they need to remember who they are and remember their identity as being member of the armed forces community. We might not always be able to see each other and be together, but we can definitely always remember together.
Ash, tell me about your granddad.
My granddad joined the Royal Air Force towards the end of World War II and became a navigator on Lancaster bombers, joining the famous Dambuster Squadron, 617 Squadron. And he talked very rarely about his service, but as we spoke more towards the end of his life, it became clear how similar we were in terms of our shared passion for service and wanting to do things for the greater good and be part of high-performing teams, etc. And as a way of honouring him, I tried before he died to give him one last flight in a Lancaster, which we managed to arrange, but sadly he was too sick because of the cancer that he was suffering from, and he died before that flight. But he left me his gold St. Christopher, something that he'd worn during all of his sorties, many sorties that he conducted, and he wanted me to take that and wear it with my own dog tags because they kept him safe during his career. He wanted to hopefully do the same for me on my operational tours. And so, you know, in terms of remembrance, you know, I think it's a very individual thing. It's a very personal thing. And there isn't one template that fits all, and nor should there be. You know, a lot of people may remember elderly relatives like my granddad and be extremely proud of their service. For others, it's you know, fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, sons and daughters who are thinking of their loved ones who didn't make it home. And for many who were actually involved in the conflicts, you know, it's a time of memory that they'd rather probably forget and may open up old wounds. And so we mustn't put one size fits all over how we, I think about remembrance. And I've certainly lost a lot of friends and colleagues and know many more who've been wounded or suffered life-changing mental or physical injuries as a result of that service. So when I hear the last post, for example, or, you know, stand with a 2-minute silence, it's about thinking of all those friends and colleagues who either paid the ultimate price. And I'm taken always very quickly back to those moments and see their faces and the incidents that unfolded and think of them. It's about that memory for me, some of whom, you know, are really struggling still. In terms of how I try and, you know, daily do my bit to remember them and think of them, you know, we often only think about these folks once a year, you know, and huge supporter of everything we do around November time to think of them all. But actually, for many of them, it isn't just a once a year event. They suffer daily, or they have memories that they have to deal with daily. And so many need or our support all year round. And, you know, given that these groups are generally fit young people, you know, the thing I do is, even when I'm feeling lazy or don't really want to get out of bed or get up in the morning, I do try and drag myself out for a run or just to get some exercise, you know, really in honor of them and respect for them, because many of them don't have the choice anymore. And I think that's sort of doing my little bit, knowing that they would have loved to be able to do that. So that keeps me going. And it's also great for my own, you know, mental health and well-being. In terms of what I would love to see change in terms of how we think about remembrance and remember, you know, it's more than just the individuals. I believe passionately that, you know, there are so many uniformed servants who put on uniforms and put their lives at risk to keep us all safe, whether that be, you know, military, doctors, nurses, firefighters, police, or the rescue services. And I'd love us to think more inclusively about them when we remember, more of a, you know, as a community, and also the families and friends, you know, on whom certainly I relied and many of my friends and colleagues relied to be able to do the jobs that we did. And I hope also, you know, for my daughter, that she'll one day be proud of the service that I did for my country. And one way that I'm personally trying to change things and do my bit is we set up something called the Unsung Foundation to shine a light on service, provide awareness of the challenges, and provide an outlet to share stories from the unsung around the world and support those charities delivering the care to those who still need it.
Ashley, certainly one thing that I'm hearing again and again during this podcast, and that's this need to look to the future and to impact people and not just remember the kind of negatives, but really grow and develop. Thank you very much. Nathan, who was Jimmy James?
Jimmy James was a squadron leader in the Royal Air Force in World War II. He was a pilot who flew Wellingtons on 9 Squadron. And he is best known as being one of the greatest escapers from the various prisoner of war camps in modern times. He was shot down in his Wellington over the Netherlands in 1940. And was immediately paraded through the streets of Berlin, which he, in his very stoic, stiff upper lip way that all of these veterans had, said that it wasn't actually too bad. You know, he was just looking in the eyes of all of the German people, looking at him as a shot down Allied warfighter. But this was pre all of the bombings in Berlin, so he just said it was a bizarre, nonchalant moment. He was then paraded up or put on buses up to Stalaglift 1 in Bath, which was on the northern coast of Germany, which was widely regarded as a really hostile and not a nice prisoner of war camp to be in. He famously then escaped from the incinerator room with one of the other prisoners, and then over the years then made 12 successful escapes from various World War II prisoner of war camps, one of which was Sachsenhausen, which was the half prisoner of war camp, half concentration camp that's on the outskirts of Berlin, which you will see on the gates there, the inscription Arbeitsmacht frei, which means work will set you free. I was lucky enough to have my photo taken next to Jimmy at these gates, which was an incredibly poignant moment he ended up there because, more famously, and what he won the Military Cross for, he was involved as one of the 76 escapers from Stalagluft 3 in Poland, as the Great Escape. So he was one of the 23 that was recaptured. But he was one of the 76 that actually got out of the 102-meter long tunnel Harry, and then disappeared into the night. Three of these escapers got away, but unfortunately 50 of them were murdered. I was lucky enough to stand above this tunnel with him in 2007, where he was regaling this amazing story, and you could see the fond memories that he had actually had in this prisoner of war camp, but then the memories quickly turned to sorrow over the 50 of his comrades that were brutally murdered by the Gestapo in the events that followed.
Dave, I know you've got your own views on Remembrance. What does it mean to you?
So for me, Remembrance is really an opportunity to look back and reflect upon the sacrifices that you know, people I've worked with, my friends, colleagues have made in the past, whether they were killed in action or whether they were injured in combat operations. It's a chance for me to really just look back and take those few minutes to just reflect on that sacrifice, but for me in a really positive way, because those sacrifices were not made for nothing. They were made for a reason, and for me that reason was to provide the rest of us with a secure and safe path forward. So it's really a chance to reflect backwards in order to look forwards and shape that future in a proper and positive light. I think that's really quite key for me. And those opportunities really do shape the way in which I conduct myself, particularly in my professional life. You know, through my research work, I received research funding from the Royal British Legion as part of their work in the Centre for Blast Injury Studies. So this is an opinion which is shared across this space, whereby you can look backwards and create a positive impact to move forward. So understanding blast injuries and understanding the impact that has on the body, and moving beyond service personnel and into the impact that conflict has on children, you know, particularly children, but also other civilians and non-combatants that are caught up in these kind of conflict environments. So working strongly and positively to create this change, particularly in this amputation space, to create a better route forward for people who have lost limbs. So looking back in this reflective way really does help to shape my way forward and keep my path really quite reinforced.
Do you think you do those that have paid the ultimate sacrifice and those that survived with injury and the military community at whole, do you think you do them proud by what you do now and what impact you're going to have in the future?
Yeah, you know, I think we have a really positive community around us, you know, particularly in this veteran space at the minute. You know, we are working tirelessly, the likes of you and I, to create this real positive change, both in physical and mental health and how people see themselves and how people see themselves moving forward post-military. So absolutely, I think they do. You know, people don't go off to conflict thinking that, you know, all of this is a waste. You know, why am I doing this? People go off and will gladly make these sacrifices because they understand that those that come after them will be making these positive changes, hopefully. So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, so the conflict ceases to happen, that's the ideal. But at least away from conflict, we can try and create these positive pathways and positive ways forward.
Glenn, you've been in the military 33 years. How has Remembrance changed for you over this time?
Remembrance has always been something close to my heart, even growing up as a youngster, as a cub, as a scout, as a cadet. I always remember going to Remembrance events as a young kid and seeing the soldiers and the service personnel at my local sort of church services on Remembrance Day. And I remember polishing my own shoes and wearing my poppy and wearing my uniform and being very proud of the fact. But I think back then when I was a kid, it meant something to me because I really remembered or thought about the First and Second World Wars. And also because of my family members had served in certainly in the Second World War. And growing up as a kid as well, when I was about 10 years old, the Falklands War played a big part in my life, watching it on the news and seeing how it unfolded. So remembrance for me as a child was really significant. And then to join the military and to become part of the military community and become a serving soldier, it brings it to life so much more. And then to serve on operations. And for me, having gone to the First Gulf War, numerous Northern Ireland tours, and then, like many others, the subsequent Iraq and Afghanistan's, to have served, to have lost colleagues, friends, people you've been incredibly close with, brings it home so much more. And I remember the first time losing someone close to me and making remembrance even more significant was a friend that was killed in Northern Ireland in the very early 90s. And that shook everyone within my company group that I was serving in then quite hard. And it really brought remembrance home to us. And every year, remembering the date that he sadly died, and then remembrance events brings it all together. But then the subsequent tours and, working up through the ranks and growing wiser and older and more experienced. And I think you become more emotionally intelligent as you get older as well. And having lost certainly 15 grenadiers from my own battle group or battalion over those tours has really brought it home to me. So it just means so much. It means a huge amount to the serving community. And long may that continue. We wear our poppies with pride for good reason. We attend these events for good reason. And I think it's the least we can do in order to pay our respects to those that paid the ultimate sacrifice for our nation. And long may that continue.
But I'm not just talking about them with us today. There's many that's fought that we've lost, don't we? We have this time at start of November. We set aside every year for us to remember them that's fought, what country and wars, and laid down their lives so as we can live ours. Too many have given that great sacrifice, too many have paid the ultimate price. But many of them that still remain will gather in London for Remembrance Parade, as tales are shared, there's laughter and tears, and crowds turn out to remember every year. I get a lump in my throat, a feeling of awe, watching great generation who fought in world wars. Seeing blokes in the 90s that can barely walk, but on Remembrance Sunday, they'll get up and they'll march. Chins high and proud and chest puffed out, with a row full of medals and dressed immaculately smart. Whole nation drops silent as last post rings true. We remember the fallen and give thanks to them too. Aussies and Kiwis and Yanks and Fijians, Canadians and Gurkhas, lads from Caribbean, Indians and Africans, the list goes on, have all good their lives, don't matter where they're from. We wear a poppy and we wear it with pride, as a symbol of remembrance for them that's died. When parade's done and dusted and wreaths are laid, I know for me sen, the memories don't fade. I'm forever grateful to brave women and men that's chosen to save others instead of the sen. To them that we've lost, I'm forever in debt, but I'll promise you summat, I'll never forget. So I take off my cap and I say to me son, at going down at sun and in the morning, we will remember them.